Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
There's an air of hushed anticipation already. I got a bit of paper here because there are certain things that I do need to say that have to be said at the beginning of all of these things. So let me start off by saying that. Well, first, I suppose, let me introduce myself. I'm Justin Webb. I present the Today programme on Radio 4. I'll tell you just in a second or so why I'm here, because you are all thinking, why is he here? He is not the slightest bit qualified to be doing this, and you're right, but there is one specific reason why I'm here. But before that, the things that I've got on this bit of paper. So, please check mobile phones are switched to silent. We are filming, and live streaming, actually, as well. So, welcome to anyone joining us online. A reminder that there is a hashtag, as there is in all decent public events these days, and it is hashtag RSAMind if you want to get involved in a discussion on Twitter. So, back to today, and before I introduce Edward and he gets going, let me first say how delighted I am to be able to do this. I am not at all qualified to do it in the sense that I have absolutely no background in this or knowledge of it, though that's not a disqualification, of course, in my line of work, because our basic job is to make sure people stand up, say their bit, and then we interrupt them a bit, and then we say, now it's time for the weather, and I'll do pretty much that today. So my real job, I know, is to get us out of here at 2 o'clock. And I promise that I will do that. And I know that beyond that, actually, there's not much I can do. But I would say in my defence, as it were, that I am probably the only person in this room to have had a conversation with Barack Obama about type 1 diabetes. One of the things that fascinated me about Edward's book was the link between chronic disease and specifically diseases that are autoimmune and what he is saying about the workings of the mind. And I gave the book to my son, who has type 1 diabetes, and he was, at the age of 18, he's not a great reader of books that come through our house, and quite a few do, but he was absolutely energized and fascinated by it, and I could see that so much of what it said rang true to him. The other aspect of it, of course, is the place of personality in our lives, where it is, where it comes from, and personality in the widest sense. And going back to Obama, when I told Obama that my son had just contracted type 1 diabetes, his autoimmune illness, and I was delighted to be able to talk to the President of the United States about it, because he had just mentioned it in a speech about stem cell research, and I'd never even heard of the damn thing before my son had got it. So thinking we were about to do an interview and thinking I wanted a proper, crunchy subject to talk to the President of the United States about while we were fiddling about with the cameras and the lights, I hit on this, and it told you everything you already knew about Obama, but confirmed this kind of personality thing that is so important in all of us, that he is cool and dispassionate, he knew all the pathways to a cure, he knew the best hospitals to go to, etc., etc., but you didn't have any of that kind of touchy-feely stuff. In fact, it actually reminded me that I'd also been there when George W. Bush was president and done quite a contentious interview with him towards the end of his time there, where Bush was such a different personality, and at the end of the interview he'd said, how's that for you, Justin? Did you like that? Was that good? And I said, thank you very much, Mr. President. Before you go, do you want to see the Oval Office? And I said, yeah, we'd love to. We went to the Oval Office. Do you want to see the Rose Garden? We go out to the Rose Garden. Do you want to see the library corridor? We go down to the library. I actually found myself saying to the President of the United States, look, I'm terribly sorry, but I've got to be somewhere else. And you do not get that with Obama. And I think one of the fascinating things about not just depression, actually, but more widely who we are as people is the extent to which those things are kind of hardwired from an early age. Anyway, what's going to happen now is Ed is going to give us an introduction to his work. a flavour of the book, I think it's fair to say, in his presentation, and then we'll have a brief follow-up conversation, and then we will open it up to you, and we'll have plenty of time for questions and comments. So, Professor Edward Bulmore on A New Approach to Depression.
Well, thank you very much, Justin, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming here to hear a bit about The Inflamed Mind, A Radical New Approach to Depression. It's a book that I've written to try and draw together what I think is a very interesting new science. It's called neuroimmunology, which is a bit of a sort of mouthful, but essentially it's a new way of looking at the connections between the nervous system, the brain, on the one hand, and the immune system on the other. It's a science that is growing, but I thought it was timely to try and write a book because I think it may be at an inflection point. I think it may have reached that point where certain important questions have been resolved, and there are some interesting speculative ways in which the field might move in future. If you haven't got time to read the book, I hope you do, but if you haven't, you might want to know that that's the final sentence or couple of sentences. We could be on the cusp of a revolution. It won't be televised. And I might be wrong, but I think it has already begun. That might make a bit more sense when I've gone through a few more slides. I just want to begin by being clear about where I come from professionally. I work for the University of Cambridge. I'm the head of the Department of Psychiatry in Cambridge, but I've also worked for the last 12 years half-time for GlaxoSmithKline, a pharmaceutical company, and I do work for the NHS, as well as these other interests. Now, the book starts, and maybe the story for me started way back when, in 1990. I was about 30. I just started training in psychiatry. I was quite pleased with myself to have arrived at the Maudsley Hospital, which then, and to some extent now still, is the kind of epicenter of British psychiatry. And there I was, a young doctor, sitting in this rather grand outpatient clinic. And I met a man not much older than me, I could call him Mr. Q, who started telling me that his mood was low, his energy was down, he'd lost pleasure in life, he felt gloomy about the future. And I said to him, I think you're depressed. And he was really not very impressed by that. He said, look, I know I'm depressed, that's why I've come to the clinic. The question is, what are you going to do about it? And I said, well, you know, of course, we could offer treatment with SSRIs, serotonin-boosting drugs, and started rattling off all the stuff I was just learning out of the textbooks about the serotonin theory of depression, how serotonin might be low and these drugs might boost it. And he looked at me and said, well, how do you know that about me? How do you know the level of serotonin is down in my brain? And for a moment, we looked at each other, and we both knew I didn't have a clue what the answer to that question was. And it stuck with me. And it's still an abiding question. Now, if we jump to where we are now, 2018, 28 years down the road, antidepressant drugs of the type that I was talking to Mr. Q about are still the mainstay, alongside psychotherapy, the mainstay of treatment for depression. And this is a recent study published in The Lancet earlier this year, which has aggregated data on tens of thousands of patients with depression. And what you can see here, these little blue squares, the extent to which they're shifted to the right of the line means the drug is working compared to placebo as an antidepressant. So you can see all of these drugs have some effect. They're all beneficial to some effect. But it's no more than a moderate effect. And all of those drugs are still working on the same basic idea, that it's serotonin or noradrenaline in the brain that is at the root of the problem. So we've got drugs that sort of work okay, but we've also got a long list of issues. We still don't know that serotonin or any of those other transmitters are actually reduced in patients who are offered treatment with these drugs. We have no way of answering the question that Mr. Q posed me 28 years ago. We can't predict who's going to respond particularly well to any of these drugs. There's been very little therapeutic progress. You know, if there was therapeutic progress, this drug up here with the biggest beneficial effect should be the most recent, and this should be the oldest. But in fact, that, amitriptyline, is one of the oldest antidepressants out there. The new drugs might be different in terms of their side effects, but they're not offering a step change in terms of efficacy. industry is pulling back. There's been less investment in R&D over the last 10 years. And yet depression is set to be the biggest single cause of disability by 2020, according to some projections. So we're in a very, I think, unsatisfactory situation where we have a major health challenge, but we seem to have run out of ideas about how to deal with it, at least pharmacologically. And that means, I think, that we have to think quite differently. We have to think a little bit out of the box, and we have to start thinking about inflammation. Now, inflammation is something that you wouldn't normally discuss in relation to mood. It's the response of the immune system to infection or threat. So if you imagine a fight amongst our ancestors on the savannah, one of them gets wounded, a knife penetrates the skin, it's covered with bacteria, that guy would probably die of sepsis, of infection, if it was not for the immune system. And these cells in the immune system, they're shown here as little kind of graphic icons, they're called macrophages. They eat bacteria. They help the body deal with that threat. And they also pump out a lot of inflammatory proteins called cytokines, which circulate through the body and tell the rest of the immune system, we've got an infection going on in a particular place, in this case the hand, we need more macrophages in reinforcement. So these macrophages deal with the infection on site, but they also send signals through the rest of the body to encourage more of these immune cells, these macrophages, to come out of the blood and get into the fight with the bacteria. And that is what causes the symptoms of inflammation, the swelling, the redness, the tenderness that we've known for many years. You might also know that this note that this caveman is not looking too happy about what's happened. And in fact, the coincidence of depression and inflammation is very, very common. And this occurred to me again about 20 years ago, just before I started in psychiatry. I met a woman in a clinic, not a patient primarily with depression. Her principal problem was arthritis, rheumatoid arthritis, an autoimmune disease of the joints. And she came into the clinic and she told me all about the swelling in her hands, and we talked a good deal about the medical symptoms of arthritis. And then I noticed that she was looking as if she might be depressed. I asked her the questions that I discussed with Mr. Q. It turned out, yep, she was depressed. I was paradoxically quite excited. I thought, oh, you know, I've doubled her diagnoses. She came in thinking she was only a patient with rheumatoid arthritis. I've turned her into a patient with rheumatoid arthritis and depression. I rushed to tell my consultant what a breakthrough I'd made, and he was, again, unimpressed. He said to me, well, she's depressed. You would be, wouldn't you? If you had arthritis, if you were coping with disability, if you knew that there was every chance that disability was going to get worse over time, you'd be pretty depressed about it too. And with that, we stopped talking about her depression, and she left the clinic exactly in the same way as she'd arrived. Now, in fairness to us both, at that time, there really wasn't another way of thinking about the coincidence of depression and inflammation, except in terms of that kind of psychological reaction. And the reason why there was no alternative was because the medical science of the time insisted that the immune system and the brain were utterly segregated. They were kept apart from each other by this so-called blood-brain barrier, which we were taught was very much like a Berlin Wall in the brain. It just prevented any of those macrophages or cytokines that I mentioned earlier. They could circulate in the blood all they liked, but they were never going to get into the brain because the bricks of the wall, as it were too adherent to each other to allow them through. So the brain was quite separate from what was going on in the body. In the brain, we had serotonin synapses, we had bits of the brain like the amygdala and the cingulate that we know are important for mood, and that was where depression was supposed to come from, in this sort of axis somehow, not at all from the body. But over the last 20 years, the Berlin Wall in the brain, like the Berlin Wall in Berlin, has fallen. And if you think now about how things are organized, there is increasing evidence that these macrophages and cytokines, these inflammatory cells and proteins in the blood, can get across the blood-brain barrier. They can get into the brain. They can excite The brain's own immune cells, the brain's own macrophages, which confusingly have a slightly different name, they're called microglia. So they can stir up inflammation in the brain, and that inflammation can damage nerves and cause some of these changes that ultimately lead to depression. That's the new way of thinking. It's a much more direct connection between what's happening in the body biologically and what's happening in the brain psychologically. And that new science allows us to think that the coincidence of depression and inflammation, which is quite common, might have a causal explanation, that inflammation might actually be causing depression in Mrs. P and many other people like her. Now, causality is a really crucial question in all of this, and it's not an easy question to nail down. But there are some ways we can do that experimentally. First of all, we can say to ourselves, as is commonly true, causes precede effects. So if inflammation caused depression, we should expect to find examples of cases where somebody was inflamed before they became depressed. And I put up this rather sort of stark piece of data just to give you an example of some of the strongest evidence out there. This is based on tens of thousands of young people who were all assessed for inflammation at the age of 9 when they were not depressed. And then 9 years later, when they were 18, they were reassessed in terms of inflammation and depression. And it turns out that if at the age of 9, your blood level of inflammation was in the top third of the distribution, your risk of depression at the age of 18 increased quite significantly, almost doubling the risk of depression at the age of 18 if you had levels of inflammation in your blood that were in the top third at the age of 9. So this is a very clear example of inflammation preceding depression. And there are many other examples I could have showed you and that we could talk about. I've had experiences in my own life, and one of the anecdotes I tell in the book is going to the dentist for root canal treatment on my tooth. It was an inflamed tooth. I got onto the chair feeling quite buoyant about life. 6 hours later, I was lying in bed thinking about the grave. And at the time, I told myself it's because the dentist has made me think I'm getting long in the tooth, yeah, mortality, it's all ruminating. And I thought I was psychologically making myself depressed as a result of the dentist visit. But I now think what happened was the dentist fiddled around with my tooth. That caused a pulse of inflammatory proteins into my blood, and that in turn caused depression. So it's another example of an inflammatory response preceding a depressive response. Okay, so if you buy the idea that inflammation can cause depression, the next question you might have is, well, where does the inflammation come from in the first place? And I've talked about autoimmune disease, and that in fact there are many other diseases where inflammation is a player and where the incidence of depression is increased. So that's always going to be one important answer. But what if you're talking about somebody that's depressed but doesn't obviously have a medical disease like rheumatoid arthritis? Where could inflammation be coming from in those circumstances? Well, there are a lot of bodily factors. I wasn't quite sure what phrase to use, but I came up with bodily factors here. There are a lot of things in the body or the physical environment that can drive low-grade inflammation. Obesity causes inflammation. The microbiome, which remember is, you know, probably our most intimate exposure to bacteria. We have millions and millions of bacteria living in our gut all the time, not all of them friendly. They can stimulate infection and low-grade inflammation. Chronic periodontitis, the issue that got me into the dentist chair, a very classic example of low-grade inflammation. There's some evidence that after the menopause, women have increased levels of inflammatory proteins. As we get older, we become more inflamed. There was an interesting paper in Nature a couple of years ago showing that over the course of the year, our inflammatory protein levels cycle in sync with the hours of daylight. When there are fewer hours of daylight in the winter, we are a little bit more inflamed. So there are many physical things that can drive inflammation. The immune system is exquisitely responsive to the outside world, as well as the internal world. But I think it's also very important and exciting in the scientific sense to recognize that there's growing evidence also that social stresses can cause inflammation. So a major stress like bereavement, caring for a dependent elderly relative, childhood adversity, these are major life events. There's some evidence accumulating that these are associated with increased inflammation. Even public speaking, what I'm doing now, is moderately stressful. And if you measured my inflammatory proteins in about 10 minutes compared to where they were 20 minutes ago, you'd find that they were spiking a little bit. Any kind of stress can trigger an inflammatory response. And that may be relevant to the link between inflammation and depression, of course. So hopefully I've persuaded you that there is an association between depression and inflammation. They often go together. That inflammation can cause depression, and that there are a number of plausible causes of the inflammation that can cause depression. But why is there this association? Why would it be a good idea to become depressed if you were inflamed? And I think the answer has to come back to Darwin. I don't think this has happened except by natural selection. So Darwin would say, well, it must be advantageous. There must be some sense in which the behavioral changes, the psychological changes of depression are advantageous to us, either now or in our ancestral past. So going back to this wounded warrior, is there any way in which a depressive response to this inflammation could possibly be helpful to him, could possibly have improved his chances of survival? Well, it's speculative, but there is a story out there. You can make a so-called just-so story about how that could be an advantage to his survival. You could reason, well, if he's withdrawing from contact with others, that might reduce the amount of risk of infection from his wound to others in the tribe. If he isolates himself, absents himself from his normal duties, conserves his energy, all of that might improve the resources he has available to fight the infection. So you can make up a kind of story about how a depressive response, a social withdrawal, a reduced amount of physical activity in response to an inflammatory trauma like this wound could be advantageous. But it is a story, and it's a difficult one to test experimentally. We can't rerun evolution with different experimental parameters to see whether we come up with a different result. But what we can do is consider the genetics, because if this association had evolved because of the depressive response to inflammation was advantageous, we might expect to find that the genes that confer risk for depression are also important for the immune system. And that's been a moot point until very recently, because until very recently we didn't know what the genes for depression were. We've known for a long time that depression runs in families, but it's taken a huge effort internationally to get big enough data sets to really identify specific genes. And this result came out again just earlier this year. This is called a Manhattan plot, if you haven't seen one of these before, because it's supposed to look like the skyline of Manhattan. And the tallest skyscrapers are telling you where on the genome — this is the whole genome stretched out in a single line — where on the genome are there specific genes associated with depression. And there's at least 44 of them identified by this analysis. And this one, the top hit here, like a number of others, turns out to be important for the immune system. This is a gene. It's called olfactomedin 4. I'd never heard of it before it popped up in this study, but it turns out it's important in controlling the inflammatory response of the gut to infection in mice. So you have a gene we knew was important for immune response, suddenly turns out to be important for depression too. But so what, you might be asking? I mean, all this is very interesting if you happen to be, like I am, scientifically interested in it, but what are the implications for treatment? Well, if inflammation causes depression, you would be right in thinking that anti-inflammatory treatments should be antidepressant. And I think that is a plausible hypothesis. But it's not proven yet, and I don't think it will ever be true for everyone. So when I think about the future therapeutically and where this might go, I see a sort of future in which depressed people, who are different in many ways, might go to their GP or their psychiatrist, instead of having just a quick conversation about how they're feeling and then getting straight into the question of whether they should have SSRIs or not, maybe they go and have a blood test. Maybe they have a biomarker measured in their blood, which would tell them and their doctor whether they were inflamed and whether that might be linked to their depression. Now, that would not be a great step forward in any other branch of medicine except psychiatry. If you go and see a physician for diabetes, he will certainly take, or she will certainly take, a blood test for glucose. It's a biomarker of diabetes. We don't have biomarkers for psychiatry yet, but I think the inflammatory approach will depend on them. We'll need to pick out quite precisely which patients with depression, and I think it's probably going to be about a third, have these low-grade inflammatory factors that might contribute. So if the biomarker result comes back positive, you might say, well, let's try a very different kind of treatment. Let's try an anti-inflammatory treatment, a bit similar to those that have recently been put out there for rheumatoid arthritis. But if the biomarker comes back negative, there are other treatments that we could offer. That would be, for me, a huge advance if we could get into a slightly more personalised, customised way of tuning treatment based on what we think are the root causes of depression in an individual patient. And the other point that I want to make about the future, and this again is a little more speculative, is it's not necessarily just about drugs. I am obviously quite interested in the idea that we might be able to find a better class of antidepressant drugs that work on the inflammatory system. But I think the science is bigger than that. I think once you start thinking about the links between the immune system and the nervous system, once you open your eyes to the idea that there might be more to it than this rather sort of simple idea about transmitters being up or down, being more or less abundant in synapses in a tiny little part of the brain, a number of other avenues open out. And this is highlighted here. This is the vagus nerve. I don't know if people have heard about that, but it's a very extensive nerve that travels into many different parts of the body and has a generally calming effect. It's the sort of opposite of an adrenaline spike, a vagal activity. But again, it's only very recently, in the last 10 years or so, that we've understood that the vagus nerve, amongst other things, gets into the immune system and it can change the levels of inflammation in the body. So you have a nerve coming out of the brain, across the blood-brain barrier, directly into the spleen, turning down the production of inflammatory proteins by cells in the spleen and making the body less inflamed. It's a very direct example of how the blood-brain barrier has been disrupted, subverted, compared to what we were taught back in the 1980s. And it also suggests that if you could stimulate the vagus nerve, that might be effective as a new treatment for depression. So there are many other approaches that might reduce inflammation, meditation, dietary changes. All of these things you can imagine could be effective. We need to see the data. But I think the biggest claim I make in the book is not really about any particular therapeutic future. It's that maybe we need to disrupt a little bit the sort of basic foundation of Western medicine, the idea of dualism, the idea that the body and mind are apart from each other, is still ubiquitous in medicine, Western medicine. And it dates back, of course, to Descartes. And I look at this diagram from his posthumous publication, and I think, what a beautiful mind, really. I mean, he's understood the physics of optics brilliantly. He understands how something you see in the outside world gets into the eyes, gets into the optic nerves. He understands how the muscles move the hand. But the bit in the middle is a void. How does that sensory stimulus trigger a movement? What happens? Of course, Descartes imagined that the pineal gland was the answer. The pineal gland was where our experience of the outside world and our bodily mechanisms met the spiritual domain. And that idea has been very powerful for medicine. And I don't want to disrespect Descartes, But that was about 400 years ago. And I wonder if we are now perhaps ready to think a little bit differently about how the body and the mind might be related to each other. So that's what led me to the sentence that I ended the book with, but started this talk with. And I'd like just to thank Helena Maxwell for her illustrations and short books, for their tremendous support in turning it into a book I'm proud of. Thank you.
A couple of things before I throw it out. Number one, it's not just medicine, is it, that's been affected by Descartes, since we are having a kicking Descartes session. It's the entire... When someone says, you know, I wasn't myself that day, we find it difficult, actually, to grasp what we are separately, or we want ourselves to be separate from our bodies. And that, in a sense, strikes me as one of the sort of fascinating philosophical areas that your book pushes us into.
Yeah. No, I mean, Descartes is everywhere. He's... the other guy I talk about in the book a lot, of course, is Freud. I mean, I think they're both giants. I don't mean to be disrespectful of either of them. And, you know, I think they're... But I think their thinking is kind of more infiltrated in the way we think about the world than we might recognise. But I think it's time to take another look. And, you know... Descartes himself, as far as I can understand, was never entirely happy with where he ended up. You know, the idea that the pineal was somehow kind of orchestrating this mysterious connection between the god and the machine. But he died of an infection before he had time to work it all out. And it's been a powerful idea for medicine in many ways. I mean, thinking about the body as a machine, I mean, that was arguably the platform which eventually moved us into an era of medicine which I'm thankful to have lived in, you know, the era of antibiotics and many effective new treatments. They're all based on a mechanistic understanding of the body. So not at all been all bad, but I think particularly for people who have psychological symptoms, or the very many people who have a mix of physical and psychological symptoms, I think this split, I call it in the book Medical Apartheid, the split within medicine between the body and the mind, I don't think has been helpful to a lot of patients.
You don't think it's helpful, and you've written this book. Is it fair to say that it is an increasingly widely shared view?
I think so. So, you know, for example, the Academy of Medical Sciences just published a report about multimorbidity, which is the kind of medical jargon for people having more than one disease at the same time, essentially. So people having a combination of mental and physical symptoms has just been the subject of a report. And I think that signals that, you know, the mainstream medical establishment is paying more attention to this than perhaps we have in the past.
But do they make the connections that you make between those things, or are they just talking about... Because I mean, we regularly on today's programme talk about the huge and growing population of people who present and who need treatment for long-term treatment for a multitude of chronic, but I'm not sure we ever quite make the connection that those things are working on each other as well. And maybe that's the place to get to. But are you saying that your profession has already got there?
I think the profession is increasingly sort of waking up to the reality that these, you know, the patients don't fit into medical specialties quite as neatly as we might think. You know, it's not like everybody who goes to see a gastroenterologist has got a gut disease and only a gut disease. Things cluster together, and particularly psychological and physical symptoms co-occur much more frequently. And of course, as I mentioned, the traditional way of dealing with that was to say, well, you would be, wouldn't you? You know, you would be depressed if you had some other physical disease of the body. I think this new awareness of how the immune system and the nervous system could talk to each other, which in a way is quite obvious once you've had your eyes open to it. I mean, it would be surprising in a way, although, you know, it wasn't until very recently that I was surprised by this, but the dualist idea that you've got two big important parts of the body, the immune system and nervous system, that simply don't talk to each other, doesn't really make sense as the new science is building. And I think what mainstream physicians and scientists want to see, and I respect this completely, is they want to see mechanistic explanations. They want to understand step by step, you know, okay, you had your root canal treatment. There were some cytokines going around your blood. Then what happened? How did it get across the blood-brain barrier? What exactly did it do to the nerve cells? How exactly did that cause mood change? I think working out that detailed step-by-step explanation is going to be really important. I think the genetics is really important, because in biomedicine today, if you haven't got a genetic hook or anchor to your story, it's regarded as a little bit rootless. So I think the genetics is going to be important. And I think the thing that will really change mainstream thinking about this is the advent of new treatments, because that's what always changed. If you look historically, that's what's always changed. The theory of medicine's often been driven into the mainstream by changes in practice.
Yeah, and treatments that work, but you don't quite know why they work at first. I mean, there are plenty of treatments that do work at the moment. We don't really know why. They're not entirely evidence-based, are they? Is there the interest, then, in the drug companies in providing those treatment? Are there areas of work that are going on now that will resolve some of these things?
I think so. I think, you know, the pharmaceutical industry as a whole is quite wary of mental health at the moment, so there's less investment than there was. You know, it's a fairly risk-averse business because the stakes are so high. So, if I was to guess, where would the industry go with this? I can think of two areas. One would be Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases, which I touch on a little bit in the book. There's pretty solid evidence that, at least in some people at some stages of Alzheimer's, you've got overactivation of the immune system in the brain. And that may actually be contributing to the damage to the brain. You know, we hear a lot about plaques and tangles and amyloid and all that stuff. And those certainly are important. But one of the things that makes them important is that the immune system sees plaques and tangles and deposits of amyloid as alien, and it attacks them. And in attacking those deposits of protein in the brain, it causes collateral damage to the nerve cells, and that may contribute to the onset of dementia. So it's a bit of a long answer, but the industry is more bullish about Alzheimer's disease, I think, than it is, for example, about major depressive disorder. And I can imagine, I know that companies are looking at that and thinking, is there a way that we could, if we could be sure, again, using a biomarker of some sort, whether somebody with Alzheimer's might have an inflammatory process going on in their brain, that might be a good one to target. Yeah. I think the other place that you might look for new therapeutics would be in the kind of Mrs. P zone, if I can put it that way. In other words, people who's got a primary diagnosis of arthritis, psoriasis, inflammatory bowel disease. We know that these disorders are very commonly associated with depression, fatigue, anxiety. If you talk to patient advocacy groups in rheumatoid arthritis, for example, they'll tell you those psychological symptoms are the main unmet need. And at the moment, we're not doing very much therapeutically. I can imagine companies thinking, well, does this new science give us a way of finding an anti-inflammatory treatment that would really make a difference to those slightly non-traditional symptoms of arthritis?
Okay, I'll pause at that stage. And yes, there are plenty of people who already want to. So let me, we've got a microphone. Yes, we've got one microphone in the back. Can I ask you to come forward? There's a gentleman and a lady right in front of me here, and then we'll go round the room, possibly take one or two at a time. Here we go.
I didn't realise. Is this on?
Yes, it's
yes,
on.
Yes, okay. Yeah. In your book, you say the sequence is essentially stress to inflammation to depression. And if people are taking SSRIs and they become obese, that presumably raises the stress that then raises the inflammation further. In other words, it compounds the situation. Because of my engineering background and my strategy management background, I'm intrigued about this notion of feedback, because you do say, maybe this isn't linear, maybe it is circular. Now, in that situation, if it is very difficult to get to the genes and the pharmacology, I do wonder if actually something could be done more locally, more modestly in the stress area, because you tell a story about a person who was in a very dysfunctional family with deep depression, and you come out saying, I believe that actually her family coming back together did most of what it was achieved to make this situation better. So with feedback loops, you get a situation where stress compounds inflammation, compounds depression, compounds stress, and so it worsens. Mm. There's a feedback loop that says, no, you could attenuate that if you could get to stress. So I just wonder if there are some modest, almost locally based matters that could be progressed. You mentioned meditation and Tai Chi, but maybe there are more things than that, because that would seem to be a hopeful way forward.
Yep. Well, thank you for your question. I agree completely. You know, there is a concept of a vicious cycle in the book, as you've just articulated. I think, to be honest, that is a cycle that, as you know, I've assembled bits of evidence that are compatible with that view. There's still more work to do to flesh it all out, but it seems very plausible to me. And you're right, if that's true, then there's no reason to think that you have to do something pharmacological in the body if you could relieve stress and the sources of stress that drive inflammation. That might be as effective. And some of those things could be quite modest, as you say. And I think it's well worth looking at those. But I think if we do that, what I do think is important is that we do it in a way which is informed by the biology. I mean, we might not be acting therapeutically on the biology. We're not giving people a drug. We might be trying to do something, help them do something in their lives to relieve sources of stress. But I would like it if we could show, perhaps using sort of these biomarkers as a kind of biofeedback, if you will. If you go to a stress management counsellor and they say, and I've seen this advertised online, a lot of people say stress management will have anti-inflammatory effects. Well, where is the evidence? And can we use these kind of biomarkers not just to predict response to drugs, but perhaps to measure the response to non-pharmacological treatments, stress management and other stress reduction tools? I think that would be great.
Mm. Okay. Yes, if we go over... Yes, have you... You get no, carry on, and then we'll go over. If the microphone could also go over to the back there, and then we'll come forwards. Yes.
Okay. I haven't read your book, so I don't know if it's covered in the book. But the only thing that's ever worked for me, and I've had major drug-resistant depression since I was about 14, was ECT back in the 70s. And now I read with hunger about this transcranial magnetic stimulation, which costs $8,000. And so is out of my reach. What do you think about those methods?
Hold that thought, because let's do a few at a time.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm an RSA fellow and somebody with conditions who's had to become a researcher in this area. And I think while stress reduction is really important, there is a cultural expectation that stress reduction is most of what people need, when in actual fact there is an entire group of people who genetically are just a little bit more vulnerable. They tend to be creative, and probably many people in this room, because they're sort of high achieving as well, who are a little bit more vulnerable and may develop conditions like histamine intolerance or mast cell activation disorder, for which stress reduction in itself isn't quite enough. So my question to you is one size fits all medicine part of the problem? The assumption that everybody has roughly the same response, because it seems to be to me.
Hold that thought too, and we'll come down to the front if we could. Thanks. Gentleman right at the front here.
Quick question regarding non-medicines. You mentioned DNA, you mentioned culture, you mentioned meditation. What about diet? Because you have cultures that eat tons of curcumin, which has been proven to reduce inflammation, and there's no commercial interest in developing medicines based on curcumin because it's patent-free, it's natural. So is there any work being done in diet? Particularly, you mentioned the links to gut, and you can link that to autism, to ME, to many other sickness.
Take them in any order you want.
Okay. Well, three very interesting questions. If I may, I'll start with the one from the lady at the back. So, one size fits all is definitely inadequate, in my opinion, to deal with depression. I mean, if you just think about how many people have an experience of depression or will, in the course of their lives, have an experience of depression, it's about one in four of us. So, you can, another way of putting that is pretty much every family on the planet is touched by depression at some point. And I just think it's inconceivable that that huge chunk of humanity is all experiencing depression for the same reason. I think there's going to be a lot of different causes of depression. And as you, as your question implied, the genetics might, well, certainly will be variable between people. But I think as we find out more about the genetics, I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out that the genes are that are important are genes that, in some sense, control our reaction to what's going on around us. So it isn't, you know, even the pursuit of the genetics isn't going to get us away from the importance of, you know, our social environment and the causes of stress around us. I think those gene-environment interactions, to use the jargon, are probably going to be quite important. Though there's going to be much more, I think, as we understand it more deeply, much more difference between people, and that should lead us to different treatments for people. And, you know, different treatments are going to work more or less well, depending on the cause of depression in an individual. Now, you asked about ECT and TMS, and the short answer is I don't know. And I don't know if anybody knows whether those interventions have effects on the immune system. I simply don't know. But I, you know, again, just to go back to this point about one size fits all, I wouldn't want people to go away thinking that I somehow have insight into the fact that everybody who's depressed is inflamed. You know, I think it could. I think it's probably about what we think at the moment is about a third of people with a diagnosis of major depressive disorder, and then you've got quite a lot of people with, you know, inflammatory disorders who are also depressed. It's still a huge number of people, but I don't want. I wouldn't want to claim it's kind of a totalitarian solution, if you will, to the issues. You asked about diet. Well, you know, going back to the microbiome, I'm thinking about, you know, that as a potential source of infection, inflammation, how the microbiome could be adjusted by diet. It's easy to see that dietary changes could have effects on the immune system, which in turn could have effects on mood, as I've outlined. And I don't have a problem with that in principle at all. But what I would say is the same as I said to this gentleman, which is it's important to stay sharp on the science. So if somebody says, I've got a dietary regime that can change your inflammatory response and might make you less depressed, they might be right. But let's see the evidence. Let's see how dietary change causes changes in immune response, inflammatory markers. And my impression is that there's not as much of that out there yet as I would like to see, but perhaps it's something that we'll see more of in the future.
Are you saying that the inflammatory markers will be there while you are depressed? Because you talked about the toothache and the almost sort of instantaneous thing there, but you also talked about those children who were tested at age 9 and then depressed much later. Can there be a gap?
Yeah. Well, you know, so that's a very interesting question. So, I mean, one of the things we've known about the immune system for a long, long time is that it's got a memory like an elephant. You know, if you're vaccinated at the age of 3 or 4 against smallpox, you will be immune against any exposure to smallpox for the rest of your life. Your immune system will, for decades, remember what smallpox looks like and what to do about it next time it sees it. And we've got, you know, it's an utterly familiar idea that the immune system has a long-term memory for infectious threat. What if you allow yourself to think, could the immune system have a long-term memory for social threat? Could any experience that threatened your survival as a child, whether it's maternal deprivation, childhood abuse, whatever it might be, could that be recognized and memorized by the immune system in the same way that the immune system would recognize a childhood infection or vaccination? I think it's a really fascinating question. And it's one of the it's one of the reasons why as a psychiatrist, I like this way of thinking, because I don't think it is divisive. within psychiatry. I don't think if you go along this line of reasoning, you have to abandon what we've already learned about the importance of stress, the importance of childhood abuse, the importance of those early risks. Yeah. But maybe there are new mechanisms, new ways of explaining those associations.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay, we'll go round again. Yes, if we can get a microphone down here to the front. And again, maybe we'll take our three short ones.
Hi, Jenny Edwards. Until recently, I ran the Mental Health Foundation. About a year ago, Sir Michael Marmot was in this building giving a lecture for us on inequalities in mental health. And he said that the other health inequalities that he's mapped in a lot of detail, actually mental health stresses are the route by which those emerge. So I was wondering if there's yet been research showing the coincidence between inflammation, stress, and social gradients, and things like discrimination, which also is an enormous social stressor for people, because that would start to show patterns and would give those who are providing health services an incentive to have a more strategic approach rather than one size fits all.
Yeah, hold that thought. Let's go back to two rows there, and then we'll come down to you.
Thank you. I'm a psychotherapist, an existential psychotherapist, but work a lot with medics and people who are diagnosed with so-called personality disorders, and depression often comes in that. And I'm wondering, it's refreshing to hear that people and medics will think outside of the boxes, but then not put them into medically unexplained symptoms or complex clients. How many generations do you think it will take?
Yeah, okay. And if you could pass the microphone right the way forward to this lady here, thank you. Okay, yeah.
Hi, I have a horrendous eye and brain disorder called CRB1. And for decades now, I have gone blind very, very slowly. For decades now, I've woken up in the morning feeling incredibly depressed. And I've used a form of meditation every morning for a minimum of 1 hour to lift myself out of that depression as much as I possibly can. And it's very successful. What has intrigued me through that period of time of watching my own brain disintegrate into darkness and then into a light show of flashing lights, which I see 24 hours a day in my brain, is that it feels entirely chemical in the way that I can move the chemistry in my head by really attacking it through my meditation. So I've been talking to ophthalmologists and psychologists about it, and recently I was asked to take part in a trial as the first person to have electrical stimulation from the outside of my skull directly into my brain. And my wife is here with me. She was in the laboratory at the time, and it worked instantaneously. And I was absolutely shocked. It was like doing all of my morning's hours meditation in 15 seconds.
Hmm. Okay, well, let's put those three in. Again, any order that you want to go in.
Well, let me start with how many generations will it take? Because I think that is the right unit of time to be thinking about. I think it's a long game. That's what I meant by it won't be televised. I think, I've been in psychiatry for 28 years, so that's, nearly two generations, or one and a half generations. And there's been tremendous growth in the science, but not yet any real change in treatment. As I said, maybe we're at an inflection point. Maybe things are going to accelerate. But I think about the next generation. I think the next generation is probably where we're going to see this really take off. Because apart from anything else, the science is challenging. I mean, the nervous system is extremely complex. The immune system, I have learned, is at least as complex. In fact, you sometimes wonder which is cleverer.
Is it your brain or is it your immune system? Who's really driving the bus? The immune system is a very, very sophisticated part of our body. And we need people that are equally expert in both. And, of course, understand the sort of psychological and mental health issues as well. And actually, there aren't very many of those people at the moment. We haven't trained them, and it goes back to the pervasiveness of dualist thinking. We've kept people siloed a little bit, so people haven't come up with that kind of dual citizenship that they're going to need. So I think it is going to take at least one more generation. I personally remain optimistic that I will see new treatments, you know, in the next 10, 15 years while I'm, you know, in a position position to see. But, yeah, I think probably one or two generations.
Yeah.
In relation to your experience with the electrical stimulation, thank you for sharing that. And I think, I have heard not exactly similar stories, but I have heard other accounts of people with precisely targeted electrical stimulation having very dramatic effects on brain states and mood states. I mean, you can see that, for example, in Parkinson's disease is an area where, you know, the science has got very sophisticated at knowing where to put stimulating electrodes to change symptoms. So it certainly can happen, and I'm delighted to hear it happen for you. I think it does need, again, targeting. I think if there's one sort of recurrent theme to all of this, as far as I'm concerned, it's that it's not one size fits all. You know, whether we're talking about ECT and TMS for depression or dietary changes, we need to be adaptive in terms of what treatment options are out there, and that needs to be informed by an understanding where the symptoms are coming from in the first place, and I would argue also informed by monitoring the response of the immune system to treatments as we go along. And finally, you asked about adversity. Again, there's not very much data out there on that at the moment. I think one, if I may do a little sort of technical digression, you know, if you're looking at the effects of big socioeconomic factors, you need big samples. Big samples tend to be, or have been historically, quite impoverished in terms of the amount of information they have about the immune system. Maybe one or two things might be measured, but it's an extremely complex system to understand. So I don't think, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if, as you suggested, you know, an experience of racial prejudice or abuse, for example, is obviously going to be a very stressful experience. If what we've learned about the links between stress and inflammation in other contexts are any guide, you might imagine that could have an impact. But as always, you know, we need to see the data, and I think those kind of extensions of this thinking to more, you know, epidemiological, population-based studies just haven't yet been done.
We have reached the metaphorical weather and the pips, I'm afraid. I'm so sorry to have to bring it to an end, but we do have to bring it to an end. People have to be in other places. But Edward will now be in another place that is quite close. It's the foyer, isn't it, where he will be signing books and possibly having at least snippets of continuing of this conversation. Thank you all very much, and thank you, Edward.
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.